Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border, Boats 2. First, I'd like to mention that I will be on the Intelligent Speech online conference. More details incoming this weekend, because we're going to be back to schedule soon, because I've decided to finally finish the boat thing, which you're going to hear today, which is going to be a bit about boats and more about KGB spying and the fun stuff. Secondly, I've applied to a teaching position in my own country. Even though I applied for a history teacher's position, they want me to put in some credentials and be an English teacher. The problem is that even though all of you guys who are listening to this show know already that, my English isn't that bad and that I can be, well, pretty well off with it, the problem is that my government doesn't, and now I need to take an IELTS test, the IELTS, as it's called, and I'll have to pay for it from my own pocket. So if you want to help me reach my 100 euro goal, of which I have about half, so I need like 50 euros more, then please do click the donate button on our webpage, theeasternborder.lv, or just continue being a Patreon supporter, even though, well, Patreon pays for my monthly bills, but right now we would really need some special help on PayPal. Now, those things out of the way, because I really need to ask for your help here, because, well, I want to use the Dan Carlin method of teaching and to get people interested, and getting an extra job would mean a couple of hundred euros more for me, and that would allow me to live a bit more comfortably than I do right now. But the thing is that this is one of those episodes where I just threw the script out after recording it two times already again because of isolation and everything. I mean, if you wanna listen to Boats 2, I mean, this is Boats 2, technically. But the information is so weird, as our lowly guy, who I mentioned in the previous Boats episodes, he just continues on his way explaining how the KGB used homosexuals, how the KGB used minorities, how the KGB basically got everyone drunk and everything. And it's a retelling of the instructions manual that I translated a while ago. And he doesn't do anything special. He sort of creates a double agency with his federal German, like West German guard, and he makes some contacts, but otherwise he just acts all according to manual, all the while spouting a homophobic nonsense in between, and just providing me a lot of headache, because 90% of the text of this whole book, which looked so promising the first time I looked at it, turned out to be, well, unusable nonsense. And yeah, if you want to learn about this thing, I wouldn't recommend this book at all. I really am looking forward to my Alaska series, but I'll give you a short rundown of what's happening there, and I'm going to get to some more interesting stories, because all he's talking about are the very same means, but he just ignores all the people's names too. He just has a lengthy first-person conversations with everyone, but he just seems to ignore all the names there, which is pretty bad. The thing is that he just keeps mentioning that about 80% of the people on board the boats were actually secret agents, and how they try to get everyone else drunk, and then he doesn't even go in-depth detail stories, because then he decides that it would be dishonorable if you would mention such stories. So yeah, I'm very sorry, but Boats 2 was just gonna be nothing, really, because if I don't want to repeat all of my KGB instructions, which I've done the previous time about using of minorities and just agents giving you a bit of a candy and then abusing you and then forcing you in to do terrible stuff, then yeah, that won't happen. And also another reason is because apparently, well, even though the book's in Latvian, the author's family contacted me and yeah, they prohibited me from using this book too in a much more explicable way. So I can't even quote the book for you. And that's combined with, I'm not sure if you heard it, but we had a bit of an issue with our caricature, political joke being published on Facebook and everywhere. And that was a caricature which I posted on Patreon and on Facebook and on Twitter. So find it there. That was a caricature about how Russian propaganda portrays all enemies. The Jewish Mason, gay liberals destroying Russia kind of thing. Very silly. Like, utterly silly, with the intention of showing how Russia's propaganda portrays its enemies, right? And we got into trouble, so we couldn't post. We were banned from posting for a while on Acast and everywhere else. And while we were banned, I was working on this episode, and I thought it was, like, going fine. But apparently, I now cannot use the quotes from this book. The book's pretty bad, as such, and I don't even know what to do. Well, then, I sat around and I figured I could give you some other stories of some spies, of some ex-KGB agents that have actually done a bit more things and that I am allowed to talk about, because Boats 2 are going to be on hold. Next episode's probably going to be about political stuff, then Stalin, then some more Soviet stories, because life's just interesting that way. But yeah. This is one of the few times where I am left at a loss, because the intellectual property owners of the said book do not want me to use the book on this show, because they decided that I am somehow pro-Putin, which I don't think they ever listened to any of my episodes, to be honest. But this stuff happens, and what can we do about it? So like I said, let's look at something in the, I did some digging about some other KGB agents that did their work and that were in the system, so to speak, during the Cold War era. And there's an article by Haaretz, which is my favorite Israeli newspaper, and they've done a nice interview about stuff, and we'll be going through a nice little collection of interviews with ex-KGB people here, because I want to give you something. If after all of my hard work and brain-crackling madness, I am no longer allowed to even use the books that I had. So, let's turn to some more interesting and more reliable sources, because, wow, I really took a 2-week break after doing all this hard work just to be slammed down. But the story is about a bearded man of 80, and apparently, according to Ofer Adaret, who published this about a year ago, he did an interview with his KGB agent, quote, "Friends and colleagues from the past occasionally come to call. He spends his days reading, writing, listening to classical music, and keeping abreast of world news. Takes a special interest in the events of his homeland, from which he fled in a trunk of a diplomatic vehicle in 1985. He hasn't been back since and will never return. A death sentence awaits him there. The charge, treason." End quote. Well, now this is already more interesting than the stuff in the book that I am not allowed to use. We're talking about Oleg Gordievsky, which is a name that still rattles off the bones of Putin and quite a few veteran KGB officials. Toward the end of the 20th century, Gordievsky, a senior officer in the Soviet Union's espionage organization, obviously, crossed the lines and became the most senior Russian spy at MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Service, of which I do not know anything about and I wish they would give me some money. For more than a decade, he passed on interesting, valuable secrets and intelligence information to his British handlers from the very heart of the Soviet agency he served in. And, well, I have to give credit where credit is due. This guy is responsible for a lot of my information about how KGB actually worked from inside. I mean, his name is all over the place. And I'm really happy to find out that, hey, he is still alive and kicking. Somehow. I guess at some point you just develop an immunity to ricin, poison, or to Novichok. Ah, lovely Novichok. Salisbury cathedrals look really awesome this day. But yeah, for more than a decade, he really passed on valuable secrets. And he just told everything to the British handlers from the very heart of the Soviet agency he served in. And he's one of the most influential spies in history because of that, because he really got his hands on some very sensitive, top secret information. The vast amount of the said information that Gordievsky provided to the British at a key historical moment, in a way, did actually change the course of the Cold War. He helped avert a nuclear war, he exposed spy rings in Britain, and provided the British, and through them the entire West, with a glimpse into the moon of the Kremlin. Among the most senior clients of the said spy, because they're obviously clients, of the high-quality intelligence he supplied, were, well, both Ronald Reagan and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Both of these people are considered controversial persons these days, but hey, we quite like them here in the Eastern Border. British historian and writer Ben McIntyre, author of several highly regarded books in the world of espionage, met with Gordievsky dozens of times in, well, past few years, and he has about 130 hours of recording his conversations with the reclusive ex-spy. That was the basis for his 2080 book, quote, The Spy and the Traitor, The Greatest Espionage Story of the Cold War, which, by the way, I own, and it's a great book. And it's a whole world of intelligentsia and all of the spyware, spycraft that happened there. And a lot of this, by the way, and we're going to get to the World War II episode at some point, so I have to mention, a lot of his information confirms and validates Viktor Suvorov's, or Vladimir Razun's, to be more accurate, claims about what was actually going on in the Soviet Union. So, yeah, to the people who have been complaining on the show that, yes, I do treat Viktor Suvorov, aka Vladimir Razun, as a historical source, because he, even though he does cherry-pick some stuff, his, well, main agenda is accurate, and he does show those documents. This spy story and what he reveals about his participation in the organization also complements Razun's statements. And now a quote from McIntyre. He lives alone, but under heavy protection and the tightest possible security. He's not scared of the Russian government. I am not sure he's scared of anything. End quote. In 2008, Gordievsky's name made headlines when he alleged that rogue elements in Moscow had tried to assassinate him by giving him, through an acquaintance, poisoned sleeping pills. He was hospitalized, unconscious for almost 3 days, but eventually recovered. Now, compare and contrast to the other murders that the KGB or the GRU or the Russian government in general have committed during the very recent past. I won't force in another Salisbury joke. Sorry about that. The incident did not dawn Gordievsky. By agreeing to be interviewed by McIntyre, knowing the information he would give, the writer would bring him to the limelight again, he proved again that he was truly unafraid. According to McIntyre, Gordievsky, quote, has astonishing powers of recall. As usual, by the way, for KGB agents, they were trained that way. Even the Putin has them. I mean, the real Putin, that is, not his body doubles, which have now been confirmed. Gordievsky, according to McIntyre, was open, occasionally irascible, and frequently very funny. He describes their meetings as, quote, friendly, professional, exhausting, and exhaustive. End quote. These encounters enabled McIntyre to tell the full story of the West's most senior spy run in the Soviet Union, as it has never been told before, according to the author. And, of course, to complete the picture, he also interviewed the MI6 officers who handled Gordievsky. Quote, he has paid a huge price for what he did, but I never heard him utter a single word of regret, McIntyre says. And that's the thing. Most of these people, they didn't defect for political or practical reasons. They defected because if you serve some government that turns out to be ultimate evil, and then you think that they could destroy the whole humanity, that at some point you have to start to wonder whether or not what you're doing is truly the right thing. And that probably could make even the hardiest folk of all of us wonder a bit. Colonel Oleg Antonovich Gordievsky was considered the special child, the genius of the Soviet intelligence services. His father was a communist, of course, served in the NKVD, Uncle Joe's special police. Slow clap for Stalin. And Gordievsky was born, as it were, quote, into the KGB in 1938 in Moscow. The whole Soviet spy thing was, well, in his family. He joined the KGB himself in 1961, rising quickly through the ranks. He was successful in every position and in every place he was posted: Scandinavia, Moscow, Britain. At the age of 46, he was appointed the head of the KGB's London Bureau, a key assignment that made him the most senior Soviet intelligence figure on British soil. However, behind the facade of the professional Soviet spy was a double agent who acted in contravention of his mission and against the country that had dispatched him to carry it out. In contrast to their spies, who were motivated by greed, a desire for revenge, or other personal material reasons, Gordievsky, like most people with a conscience, betrayed his country for ideological reasons and asked for nothing in return. And that is the most important part here, because a lot of Soviet spies who had a conscience, as they were very intelligent people, really understood that the Soviet system and all the horrors that it brought was just not worth it. It was the same as being a Gestapo person, really. There were some people with conscience there as well. But if you understand that you work for something that is truly evil, well, maybe you have to shift sides. McIntyre notes that money is still the most important single factor in spying, the oil of which the machinery runs. But Gordievsky was a different species, an ideological spy. He was motivated by a variety of factors, although ideology was the principal one. McIntyre writes that in his quote-unquote job interview with his British handlers in 1974, Gordievsky told them, "No money. I want to work for the West out of ideological conviction, not for gain." And that's the important part, by the way, which I have to mention here, because working for money means that you're under someone's control. By refusing money and by just doing it for ideological reasons, he could kind of align himself and not sell out his own personal ambitions and his personal thoughts on many an issue. He could just still remain himself, still remain being a human being while not being under control of the Secret Services. Finally, at the very end, of course, he did agree to take some money, which was deposited for him in a London bank account and was earmarked for an emergency situation, which did, obviously, eventually come to pass, in which he would have to defect and live permanently in Britain. According to McIntyre, his value exceeded any amount of money. A product, like all of us living here, of our beloved, glorious communist regime. Who does not love beet in the winter? Ha ha, comrade. Yeah, I like making those silly jokes. I haven't made them in such a long while. Gordievsky was obviously familiar with the ruthless cruelty of the KGB, as we all were. From the moment he relinquished the idea of absolute obedience to the government in Moscow, he decided to attack it with all that he could. A natural reaction. Well, look at me for one. The first cracks in his belief in the system emerged in the wake of the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961, which apparently shook him deeply. 7 years later, when the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, his loathing for the communist regime became intense. "This brutal attack on innocent people made me hate it with a burning, passionate hatred." That's quoting McIntyre. I'm talking about Czechoslovakia in 1968. Yeah, recently you might have heard that in Prague, a Soviet monument was demolished, a monument to Mr. Konev. Konev was a Soviet general, then later on marshal, who liberated the Prague from the Nazis. Even though in the Eastern European sphere, when we talk about Soviets coming in, we very rarely use the word liberation. Because, oh, the joys of liberation that we had. Oh, the gulags and the purges and everything. It was no liberation. It was just another form of enslavement, as the listeners of my show might as well know. Now, that is by no means justifying and defending the Nazi regime. They were also terrible monsters. But the Soviets calling anything liberation is just as much as calling everyone who was born in the United States of America a Native American. That's about the same level of accuracy there. Now, the thing that happened was that some Prague district decided to remove monument to Konev and place it in a museum because Mr. Konev had managed to get himself in a bit of a trouble. As you see, he didn't only liberate, quote-unquote, Prague from the Nazis in 1945, he also was one of the main generals of this nice little oppressive force going into Czechoslovakia in 1968. He was the tank commander of the Soviet army that brutally crushed the Prague Spring. And Prague, still up until this year, had a monument put up there by their Soviet leadership to this very man, who also sort of liberated them from the Nazis, and at the same time crushed their liberties, their desire for liberty, and everything they had held dear in 1968. Obviously, the Russian embassy had called for apology for that, and they totally said that the Czechs were licking the Nazis' boots and they were all actually real Nazis. Just the same as they do with Poland, saying that the Poland was in cahoots with the Nazis, actually, even though they themselves were. Then they also have this idea of the Munich Pact, which basically states that in all reality, the French and the British and Americans were actually working together with the Nazis to bring down the Soviet Union. They disregard land lease and all those things. It's just some part of their ultra-nationalistic Soviet World War II mythic nightmares. We're going to get to them one day. But yeah, basically, Konev managed to screw things over, and his monument was removed, and some nice little people in Prague put a nice little toilet, a portable toilet, on top of the postament where Konev's monument had stood. And that was treated as the ultimate insult to the Soviet authorities. Modern Russian authorities, but at this point they could be used interchangeably. So now Russia is just crazy because people in Prague decided to remove the monument of Konev and put up a toilet seat on top of the ex-postament because of all the terrible things that Konev did in 1968. So, yeah, the repression was pretty terrible. But now, let's get back to our spy.
Hey guys, Annette here. I hope you are enjoying our new episode of The Eastern Border. As always, a big thank you to all of our Patreons. The show would not be possible without your help. If you are not a Patreon and would like to become one, head over to the Eastern Border page on patreon.com. Please remember to also follow us on our social media, like Twitter, where we are known as Eastern_Border, and on our Facebook page. We also have a Discord server, so if you're interested in that, find a link in the description of this podcast. That's it for now. See you online.
This podcast brought to you by RussianVoiceovers.eu. Enjoy.
So, as we all know, the KGB was the most complex and far-reaching intelligence agency ever created. Many authors acknowledge that, and I say KGB beat CIA every day of the week. They had less money, sure, but the dedication and the training, well, not very familiar with the CIA operations, but if the all of the nice men from Langley who do listen to this show would kind of counteract that, again, give me some money, because hey, it's boss time I've gotten money from Western intelligence agencies. But yeah, the KGB was truly awesome. Obviously, its missions included the collection and analysis of information, political warfare, media manipulation, yeah, not like they've stopped now, spreading disinformation, again, forgery, intimidation, abduction, and murder! Oh boy, I have to love murder. It's Uncle Joe's favorite. And McIntyre writes, quote, "Oppressive, mysterious, and ubiquitous, the KGB penetrated and controlled every aspect of Soviet life," end quote. And that is completely true. At the peak of its power, more than 1 million officers, agents, and informers served in the KGB, and it truly did shape the Soviet society more profoundly than any other institution. And the thing is that, obviously, it created the web of fear, as we've spoken in the last, like, many episodes, and it was just a thing that was everywhere. From its inception, the KG operated without ethical restraint and was unapologetically unprincipled. They did what needed to be done at all times. Gurdjieffski initially tried to make contact with West himself. In 1965, he was posted to Denmark to supervise KGB secret agents there. Officially, he was a consular official, as they all were. One nice day in 1968, following the abrupt end to the Prague Spring, he called his wife Yelena and started to revile and denounce the Soviet Union. Knowing the Danish Secret Service was tapping the embassy's phones, he hoped that someone would get the message and try to recruit him as a double agent. Phone call, he wrote later in his memoirs, was a first deliberate signal to the West. However, as McIntyre writes, the West missed the signal. Amid the flood of material that passes through the hands of intelligence personnel, the signal from the KGB went unnoticed. Nonetheless, Danish intelligence subsequently tried to recruit Gordievsky, and this time it was he who missed the signal. The Danes kept him under surveillance, as is customary with foreign diplomats. When their suspicions that he was more than just a simple diplomat grew, they tried to set a trap for him. Thinking wrongly that Gordievsky was gay, which again, using homosexual contact was much used in the Cold War, they sent a young agent to try to seduce him. The two met, as though by chance, at the reception at the residence of a West German diplomat, to which Gordievsky had been invited as a Russian diplomat. But Gordievsky, unmoved by the efforts of the flirtation, turned down the young man's invitation to have a drink with him in a pub. Later, when he was still in Copenhagen, the British tried their hand. Gordievsky's name had come up in the debriefing of a Soviet defector from the intelligence service who had known him as a student in Moscow from their joint pastime, which was cross-country running, popular then as always and now. The defector had told the British that Gordievsky had shown, quote, clear signs of political disillusionment and portrayed him as a potential target for recruitment. At first, they sent a beautiful young woman to entice him, a dentistry student who would later become a world champion in badminton, no less, a sport that Gordievsky also played. The plan failed, though. Gordievsky had a couple of drinks, chatted with the woman briefly, and was on his way.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Again, one of the more interesting things of a nice, beautiful training. Finally, the head of the local MI6 station himself undertook the recruiting mission. As described in McIntyre's book, the courtship went on for a while and included a chance meetings of the two at diplomatic receptions and athletic clubs. In the end, the British officer suggested straight out that the two meet in private. Gordievsky agreed. His career as a double agent began in 1974. He continued to fulfill his official duties as a KGB agent who collected information and sent it to Moscow, but in secret he was also passing on information that came his way to the British. To have a spy planted deep within the KGB was the dream of every Western intelligence agency at the time. However, as CIA Director Richard Helms observed, realizing such a dream was, quote, as improbable as placing resident spies in the planet Mars, end quote. Until Gordievsky's recruitment, the West had very few effective agents in the Soviet Union, meaning that no reliable information existed about Moscow's long-range plans and intentions. But now, the picture had changed. In a letter explaining his decision to become a double agent, which he sent to his British handlers, Gordievsky wrote, quote, I must emphasize that my decision is not the result of irresponsibility or instability of character on my part. It has been preceded by a long spiritual struggle and by agonizing emotion and even deeper disappointments at developments in my own country, and my own experiences have brought me to believe that democracy and the tolerance of humanity that follows it represents the only road for my country. The present regime is the antithesis of democracy to an extent which Westerners can never fully grasp. I have to agree with the latter part, but I'm trying my best to make sure that the West indeed does grasp. If a man realizes this, he must show the courage of his convictions and do something himself to prevent slavery from encroaching further upon the realms of freedom. And on another occasion, he told his handlers, quote, I want to find out the most secret, the most important, the essential elements in the Soviet leadership. I want to find out how the system works. McIntyre sees in these declarations, quote, the essence of Gordievsky's rebellion, end quote. The discovery of every possible thing about the regime he abhorred in order to help topple it faster. According to the author, Gordievsky believed that his espionage activity for the West was a form of cultural rebellion, not an act of treason. Just as Shostakovich, the composer, fought back with music, and Solzhenitsyn, the writer, fought back with words, so I, the KGB man, could only operate through my own intelligence world, Gordievsky is quoted. Still, McIntyre, who is well-grounded in the intricate world of espionage, admits that even in an exceptional case like this, it is impossible to talk about a spy being driven exclusively by ideology. The inner world that drove Oleg is more obscure. Quote, he writes in the book noting several additional factors that impelled Gordievsky to become a double agent. He was, for example, motivated by a taste for adventure and romance, a need to rebel against his father, an urge to take revenge against his KGB colleagues, whom he viewed as ignorant, lazy rogues who won promotions thanks to sycophancy and internal politics, a desire for self-fulfillment, and a search for love in the wake of a failed marriage. So, how did Gordievsky transmit the information he received from Moscow to the British? At the time, messages and instructions from KGB headquarters reached the Soviet embassy in Copenhagen on long strips of microfilm, sent with a diplomatic pouch, whose contents under international law were not subject to scrutiny by the host country. Each such strip contained letters, memoranda, and other documents. Gordievsky managed to smuggle the microfilms out of the embassy building for half an hour during the lunch break and passed them on to a British agent posting as an innocent bystander outside. The latter took the microfilm to a nearby safe house and copied them using a small mobile device that the British developed specifically for the purpose. Within a short time, Gordievsky could return to his office and put the original microfilm back without anyone being the wiser. The British thus came into the possession of hundreds of documents from the Soviet embassy in Denmark, where he was stationed through the early 1980s, which included details about operations, codenames, instructions, and secret surveys. Gordievsky would later pass on information at clandestine meetings with his handlers held in the safe house. In this, he was aided by one of the traits that made him such a superb spy, his phenomenal memory. Quote, most people tell a version of the past and then either stick to it or embellish it. But Gordievsky's powers of recall were different. He was able to store prodigious amounts of information in his memory, including the content of conversations he had held and their context, and to analyze them and extract pointed insights. The result, according to McIntyre, was the single greatest operational download in MI6 history and astonishingly meticulous and comprehensive insight into the KGB, past, present, and future. And I do have to say that is just as expected from a KGB agent. The British abetted Gordievsky's success as a KGB spy in order to spur his promotion and thereby enable him to supply more highly classified information. To that end, they provided him with real intelligence about Britain, which was interesting enough to intrigue the Russians, but would not put the kingdom's security in risk. In spy jargon, such information is known as chicken feed. Bulky, filling, but lacking in any real nutritional value, McIntyre notes. The information included reports on British-United States relations and internal gossip from the Conservative Party that was gleaned at political conferences. Much of what Gordievsky was given to pass on came from, quote, open-source information such as magazines and newspapers. With some imagination, these could be made to seem like gathered intelligence, end quote, McIntyre explains in the book. But the British went further. To satisfy Gordievsky's bosses in Moscow, they created genuine liaisons for him who conveyed real, albeit worthless, information. As such, Gordievsky could boast to his superiors about sources he had supposedly recruited. The tactic worked. Gordievsky was promoted and posted to London. The British could not have hoped for a better source, a senior KGB officer serving on their soil. In 1981, Gordievsky dropped a bombshell. He reported to the British that MP Michael Foot, the head of the opposition Labour Party and its candidate to become the next Prime Minister, had in the past been a paid KGB agent. The information Foot had supplied to the Russians dealt with internecine battles within the Labour and with the party's view on such issues as the war in Vietnam. British intelligence decided to wait before passing on this information to the country's leadership. The great fear was that if Foot were to defeat Thatcher in the 1984 election, the Soviets would have their own man in 10 Downing Street. In the end, the problem resolved itself. Thatcher won the election in a landslide, and Foot resigned as a party leader. Thanks to the information Gordievsky supplied over the years, Western leaders realized how greatly Moscow feared them. Accordingly, they were able to deploy appropriately to avert war that was liable to erupt if the Soviets were to misread the intentions of the Western countries. In 1983, for example, Gordievsky provided the British with a cable sent from Moscow to the London embassy, warning that the United States and NATO were contemplating a nuclear first strike against the Soviet Union. The cable added that they were capable of launching missiles within 7 to 10 days of making that decision. Gordievsky passed on to the British information about the measures the Russians were taking in the event of a worst-case scenario. This included surveillance to detect quote-unquote unusual activity at missile bases, at British government bunkers, and at 10 Downing Street as part of the search for evidence at frantic activity. On the basis of the spies' reports, the British understood that Moscow feared that a NATO exercise was a cover for an attack by the West on the Soviet Union. In the wake of this information, the United States reduced its activity, and NATO deliberately changed some aspects of its maneuvers in order to signal to the Russians that it was business as usual, and thus prevented any escalation. The vast amount of information Gordievsky passed on also made it clear to the West that the KGB was now far from its threatening image, and that it functioned like a faltering, clumsy, and inefficient organization, as it sadly continues to do up until today. Now, don't take this the wrong way. The KGB was still an extensive, well-funded, and explicitly, awesomely cruel institution, but its ranks at that point also included many-time servers and bootlickers, lazy careerists with little imagination. The KGB was still a dangerous antagonist, but its vulnerabilities and deficiencies were, at this point, very much exposed. Because of Gordievsky, both Reagan and Thatcher revised their attitudes about the Cold War. His reports, in fact, indicated that the Soviets' apprehensions were now liable to pose greater danger than their aggression. 3 years had taught me something surprising about the Russians, Reagan wrote in his memoirs. Many people at the top of the Soviet hierarchy were generally afraid of America and Americans. I began to realize that many Soviet officials feared us not only as adversaries but as potential aggressors who might hurl nuclear weapons at them in a first strike. Which is exactly how many Russians still view the United States today. The valuable information Gordievsky provided prompted the Reagan administration to tone down its anti-Soviet rhetoric, while Thatcher decided to meet Moscow halfway, abandon talk about axes of evil, and make an effort to end the Cold War. Indeed, Kremlin's paranoia diminished noticeably. However, so did the whole rest of the Soviet Union. A good example of Gordievsky's critical contribution is the historic visit by Mikhail Gorbachev, at the time the General Secretary of the General Committee of the Communist Party. Ah, the Central Committee. And he visited Britain in 1984. As the KGB resident in London, Gordievsky was asked to provide quality intel ahead of Gorbachev's meeting with Thatcher. His handlers in British intelligence delivered the goods. The mutual espionage continued during the talks themselves. Every evening, Gorbachev asked the KGB for a detailed memorandum that would include, quote, a forecast of the line the next day's meeting would take, end quote. British intelligence supplied Gordievsky with exactly what Gorbachev wanted, including documents drawn up by Foreign Secretary Geoffrey Ho, listing the subjects to be discussed with Gorbachev and his aides the next day. In the end, Gordievsky advised Gorbachev as to what to say to Thatcher to ensure a successful meeting, and at the same time advised the British Prime Minister what to say to her Russian guest. Thus, in unprecedented circumstances in the history of intelligence, McIntyre notes, a spy shaped the course of a meeting between two international leaders and, in large measure, determined its results. Asked why he chose to devote such great resources to telling Gordievsky's life story, McIntyre replies, quote, Oleg Gordievsky is one of the few spies in history to make a strategic difference in the way states behave. The intelligence he provided from the heart of the Kremlin was going direct to the desks of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, changing the way they saw the Soviet Union, paving the way for the beginning of the end of the Cold War. As such, he sums up, Gordievsky made all of us a little safer. McIntyre observes that very occasionally spies have a profound impact on history. The breaking of the Enigma Code, for example, shortened the World War II by at least a year, he says. Espionage and strategic deception aided the Normandy landings. The Soviets' infiltration of the West's espionage systems in the 1930s and 1940s gave Stalin a critical advantage on his dealings with the West. The pantheon of the world, changing spies, is small and select, and Oleg Gordievsky is in it, McIntyre writes. In 1985, the KGB discovered the truth about the officer it had planted in London, ordered him back to Moscow, and interrogated him using its usual modus operandi. Its agents gave Gordievsky brandy spiked with a truth serum to loosen his tongue, broke into his home in the Russian capital in his absence, and spread his shoes and clothes with an invisible radioactive powder that could be detected with special glasses. With a Geiger counter, they tracked the spy's movements by means of the trail of dust he left behind. It was ultimately an American double agent, Aldrich Ames, a CIA officer, who informed on Gordievsky to Moscow. Like Gordievsky, Ames took advantage of the information that came his way to provide valuable material to the intelligence organization of an enemy country. But his trajectory was the opposite of Gordievsky's. He passed on the secrets from West to Russia in return for money. Today, he's serving a life sentence in the United States of America. For his part, Gordievsky decided to set in motion a daring escape plan that the British had devised for him. He reached neighboring Finland and freedom in the trunk of a British diplomatic vehicle. He thus accomplished the impossible. No suspected spy had ever escaped from the Soviet Union while under KGB surveillance, writes McIntyre. And that is true, because, well, my favorite spy, Vladimir Razun, or Viktor Suvorov, which again I'm going to quote in future episodes, he was from GRU, and he wasn't under surveillance when he defected and escaped. McIntyre's book, by the way, which I highly recommend for you to read in full, devotes considerable space to the escape operation, which is like something out of a James Bond movie, as should be expected. At the height of the escape, when the Russians brought a dog to sniff outside the trunk where Gordievsky was hiding, the British wielded a different weapon, quote, never deployed before in the Cold War under any other, end quote. McIntyre writes, the wife of Gordievsky's British handler, who was in the car with her baby daughter, placed the infant on the trunk of the car directly above the spy and changed her diaper, and the smell confounded the sniffer dog, apparently. Gordievsky left his wife and two daughters behind, though, and that's another sad story of Soviet defections. They always end up in personal tragedy. Yelena had known nothing about her husband's double life. 6 years after he was smuggled out of the Soviet Union, the British were able, through diplomatic contacts, to bring his family to England. A contributing factor was the thaw in relations of the West just before the USSR collapsed. But this story doesn't have a happy ending. The couple parted forever in 1993, their relationship destroyed by the battle between the KGB and MI6, between communism and the West. The marriage had been conceived amid the impossible contradictions of the Cold War espionage, and died, just as the war was ending. And this, my dear comrades, is a much better story than the boats. And I hope you enjoyed it. And we are moving towards the Russian Alaska soon. Oh, and Stalin too. But please go to easternborder.lv and press that donate button, because I really need that IELTS exam. До свидания, товарищи.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The Dark Myths Void.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.